Thanks for downloading a 3CR podcast. 3CR is an independent community radio station based in Melbourne, Australia. We need your financial support to keep going. Go to www.3cr.org.au for more information and to donate online. Now stay tuned for your 3CR podcast.
You're listening to Radical Philosophy on Radio 3CR, 855 on your AM dial.
So glad you tuned in to Radical Philosophy. I'm your host, Beth Matthews. Today on the program, I'm going to be speaking with Dr. Laura Jocic about the role of dress in colonial Australian society. Welcome to the program.
Thank you for having me on.
Oh, it's a really interesting topic. I'm so glad you could make it. So can you give us a little bit of background information about yourself?
Yes, well, I've worked in the cultural sector, first in film and theatre as a costume maker, and for the last 30 years in museums and galleries. Last year I completed a PhD in the School of Historical and Philosophical Studies at the University of Melbourne on that topic, the role of dress in colonial Australian society. And I'm currently an associate teaching fellow at Deakin University, teaching in cultural heritage and museum studies.
Right. So what was it that propelled you into studying the role of dress in colonial Australian society?
I've always been interested in dress and its creative possibilities and what it can tell us about ourselves and the society we live in. My first job in the museum environment was in the mid-1990s after I'd completed the postgraduate course in art curatorship at the University of Melbourne. I was one of the early graduates from that course. And I got a job. It was a really lovely contract at Werribee Park, which is a grand 1870s Italianate historic house just outside of Melbourne. And they wanted somebody to produce what they called a costume report on what the Chirnside family and their servants and farm workers would have worn at the height of their occupation of the property in the 1880s. So they were interested in this for two reasons, really. One was for the dressing of the costume guides within the house and also the people that were working around the property during opening hours when visitors came. So, for instance, types of farm workers and people working in the gardens because they were going the whole hog in having everyone in period dress. So they wanted to understand better the nuances about dress, the differences between the people who lived in the house, the servants, and, for instance, the farm labourers. The other aspect was just about interpretation within the house and the role of dress, and particularly these type of differences that you do see in dress at that time. So that was really, while I'd been heading in that trajectory, when that job came up, I was thrilled to get it and work at an historic site like Werribee Park. So then I continued to work in that area and work in museums as well. But there are not so many jobs that are specifically focused in working on fashion and textile collections, though they are dispersed around historic societies and museums around the country. I went to actually work in New Zealand and had the privilege of working first at the Auckland Museum and then at the Auckland Art Gallery. And while I was there, colleagues at the Auckland Museum, Angela Lassig and Tracy Wedge and I, who were all passionate and working in the area of fashion and textiles, decided that what was missing in the country was a society that would bring people who were working across this discipline, interdisciplinary areas, and form a society. So we founded what is called the Costume and Textile Society of New Zealand, CTANS, in 2001. And happily, though I have long left New Zealand, it is still going strong with an annual symposium and a publication called Context. And it's been a great forum to bring people from around the country together to just speak to each other and share information and their research, and that's ongoing throughout the year because people get to know one another.
Yeah, no, that's really amazing that you thought to do that. So how do you think that women express themselves by the type of clothing they wore?
That's an interesting question in the 19th century, and particularly within the Australian colonial context. Perhaps unsurprisingly, it appears to be very varied and individual. And we have to think about the particular context in which each woman found herself, where she was living, what was available, and what the social mores and expectations were. And important here is the aspect of gender and the role that the regulatory role that women played within the home and upholding social standards, even more so probably than men. So dress was an important part of that, keeping appearing appropriately dressed, neat, clean, cleanliness was important, providing clothing for your family, whether you were sewing in the home yourself or making judicious decisions about clothing and the life of clothing and how you could reuse fabric in, for instance, garments. Women in the home were often sewing for their children, and an old dress they might cut up again and make into clothing for their daughters, for instance. So, how they express themselves, I think, very much through the lens of what was expected. I have a colleague, Lorinda Kramer, who's done some very deep work on dress and identity on the Victorian goldfields in the 1850s, and has published her work with that title. And she really digs down into the gender aspect and how women were managing their clothing, the plain sewing in the home, and the importance of that. And I will say now what seems obvious, but we often forget, is that this was before the sewing machine was invented. And we tend to think that, well, we forget when it was invented. The domestic sewing machine was only first available in the early 1850s, but it was expensive. So it wasn't available to everyone, and women were doing what was considered to be, you know, arduous, mindless, plain sewing, which is just stitching hems, long seams, making curtains, table linen, and clothing. And so this is an important factor to think about when we look at surviving garments and the fact that they are hand-stitched from this era and what that might have meant for women and their work. And they do write, when they write in their letters and they talk about their work, that's the term they use, it is their needlework, their sewing.
Yeah, some of it's just absolutely extraordinary, isn't it? It's just, and the quality of the fabric was so much better quality back in those days, wasn't it?
Oh, there was actually a range of quality of fabrics, and this was talked about. And that's another aspect about women's role in the home, mm-hmm. was being particular about what they could afford within their budget, so managing their household budgets and buying the best fabric that they could afford that would be long-lasting. So there's one person's letters that I've looked at, and she talks about women in the bush and the hawkers coming round and selling fabrics, and that the women on these properties, were very particular about the fabrics that they chose, and they couldn't be sold substandard fabric because they knew it had to last and be made over as well and have a life beyond perhaps that first garment and be reinvented into the children's clothing as well. Another aspect is going further back, which I researched in my thesis, was the supply of convict clothing and where there was shoddy material and shoddy making for convict clothing. Now, we're talking about the 1790s here, and complaints about fabric not being suitable or garments falling apart too quickly because of quick stitching. And this type of ready-made clothing was actually done under contract and a type of mass production that was happening in the 18th century. Again, another aspect that we forget about. We think about fast fashion being something particularly 20th century, but it's there for mass production in the 18th century.
Wow, I'd never thought about the prison clothing. I sort of just imagined back in those days that you'd be wearing something like a chaff bag, wouldn't you?
Yes, and the supply of clothing, when you go to the records and the dispatches, early on, you know, from 1788 onwards at Sydney Cove, Governor Arthur Phillip is writing about it. It consumes quite a bit of his time, the supply not only of food but clothing, the two necessary items to keep the colony going. And what was the suitable type of fabric and complaints about unsuitable types of fabric and clothing that were sent from Britain.
Now, yeah, I think you sort of touched on this before about the different type of clothing for people doing different jobs, but there was pretty well a class system by the type of clothing you wore, wasn't there?
Yes, I mean, the idea that Australian settler colonial society was a classless one is misleading. I mean, first of all, we have those arriving in 1788 with a very strong class distinction. You have what was called the bond and free, the convict, the convicted felons, and those who were their masters, who for the first few years were actually naval men. That in itself is the first huge distinction, and what they were wearing. So, as I mentioned, the convicts were supplied with clothing. We often think of it as we have in our mind's eye the type of clothing that's called the party coloured clothing, the two coloured, yellow and black, that we think of for Port Arthur, for instance, where a number of original items do survive there in their collection. But the convicts, that was for recalcitrant, second offending convicts and hard labour, and they were marked out in that way. But in general, convicts wore and were issued with labouring clothing, clothing of the labouring classes. So trousers and sort of frock tops and shirts and hats and boots. And the main distinction was those who were the so-called prison guards in this open prison earlier on at Sydney were in uniform. But the very interesting thing was in the first few years, supplies did not arrive. So there were complaints about all of them being in rags and shortage of shoes, for instance, and that caused great consternation and a breakdown too of visual differences that were, you know, evident and being maintained within this society through dress. So that was a great concern, and supply of food as well. And so they had to send ships off to more close colonies like Batavia, the Dutch colony at Batavia, particularly for food, for interim supplies before they came from Britain.
Yeah, that's interesting. And I mean, look, also I would include in dress jewellery as well. Like, I imagine that if you had a brooch, or look, a friend of mine, she has the most gorgeous hair clip, and you can see it's sterling silver, and it's in the shape of a dragonfly. And as soon as you see it, you think, oh, that's just, you know, it's quality. And she wears it every day. And every day I see her, I think, oh, there's that lovely hair clip. But I suppose back in those days, if you had an item of jewellery like that, it would just be so precious, wouldn't it?
It was. And there's evidence certainly from archaeological findings and digs in the rocks, which was the first area that was settled in Sydney Cove. Really interesting finds about what people had and what they owned. And it also being an area where convicts and emancipated convicts settled. And there's been really interesting research done about the idea that, which is certainly substantiated, that convicts and people of the labouring classes who arrived in the colony actually had more disposable income. And the first thing that people tend to do is purchase small luxuries like better clothing and trinkets, if you like, and bits of jewellery. And another thing is, you know, better crockery, for instance, for their homes. And all of these types of things have been found in the archaeological digs in the rocks. And so there is this fact that, you know, that Australia became to be seen as the years progressed and into the early 19th century as the working man's paradise, because you could come and be your own master and earn a good wage and have a better standard of life.
Yeah, especially with the crockery. I remember my mother told me that if she broke a plate, it was like a tragedy. And her mother would get very upset because it was so expensive to replace. And it's one thing she never worried about. If anybody broke a plate, it's no big deal. It's okay, you know. So it was certainly a different time back then. But so could you tell us about Anne King's dress?
Anna King, yes. This is one of my favourite pieces of research. Because it really pushed my thinking, and it was probably the first garment that I started to work on very deeply at the beginning of my PhD, and it raised a lot of questions. So this is the interesting thing about when you actually take a material culture approach, as it's called, when you go to objects themselves, there's the idea that objects prompt questions and can open up new areas of research and thinking. So Anna King's dress dates to about circa 1805. She was the third governor of New South Wales' wife, and he was governor from 1800 to 1806. And this dress is one of the earliest garments to have an Australian colonial provenance. And it stayed within the King family for years, and now it sits in the collection of the National Trust in New South Wales, directly passed down through the family, so really good provenance. It is a garment that's sort of fairly typical. It's an Indian muslin that's been embroidered with metallic flattened, for a better word, thread. It's not thread, it's flattened metal gilt and gilded metal. And it's typical of the sort of rich Indian textiles that were exported from India to Britain and very popular. And so it wasn't a cheap fabric at all. And it has been brought up as the indication of the early trade between India and the colony at Sydney. And so I started off thinking, yes, good. But then I turned to Anna King herself and her life and the context of her coming to the colony. And was quite astounded, first of all, that arriving in 1800, this was not the first time she'd been to live in the colony. She'd arrived in late 1791, when she'd just married in Britain, and she left knowing that she was going to live in this fledgling colony. But even more so, it wasn't Sydney. She went to Norfolk Island in 1791, where her husband was the superintendent, and he'd been since 1788. So they'd returned back I think it was about 1796, they'd returned back to Britain. So when she came in 1800 and left in 1799, she actually knew what she was coming to and prepared herself as the governor's wife. And in her journal, her shipboard diary, she, you know, were thankful that unfortunately the seawater got into her trunks in the hold. And when she did bring them up at some time during the voyage, as people often did to change over their clothes, she writes and records in her journal that her muslins have been ruined and that she's a few dresses short. So here we have an indication that she was travelling out with her muslins, probably dress lengths, because often when they talk about dress at that time, they're often talking about a dress length. And so I started thinking about this, that probably in all likelihood this fabric wasn't an indication of the early direct trade between India and New South Wales, but she herself had been very active in making decisions about what she was going to bring when she departed in 1799 with knowledge of what life would be like in the colony. So that just is how an object, and when you start looking at the associated text-base information and the context, how an object can complicate your thinking. Yeah. And then the other question I had was, who probably made this dress? There were questions saying, well, probably made by a dressmaker in the colony, maybe an emancipated convict. That could be the case, but then we know that Anna King was sewing in the home herself as well. So that's a question to be raised as well, in who actually made the dress.
Yeah, I was going to ask you, look, how did people get the patterns for the dresses? Were they sort of passed around towns, or did people make their own patterns?
Oh, that's a great question. At this early point, people, they could take a pattern off an existing dress. Mm. Dressmakers often draped, as we call it, is a process now of garment making. That's bespoke garment making, so making for a particular body, for a person. So draping a calico on the body to get the basic shape. And that often that calico that was used, or the internal cotton lining, for instance, was used as the lining of the dress. And so it had a purpose as well. But this is a whole area about the skill of dressmaking and the variations in the skill of dressmaking. So people could make in the home, and they might copy or make over from garments that they had, and then the decision to actually pay a dressmaker who is skilled in this area is another question. So you find within people's wardrobes, and what they're saying in their letters is they're doing a mixture of things, sewing in the home and then employing a dressmaker when required.
This is part one of a two-part interview. Well, it's been great having you on the program today.
Thanks Thank you coming. Very much. As you can see, there's a lot. I can go down many rabbit holes about areas of, you know, particularly fashion and textiles within the Australian colonial context.
And I've been speaking with Dr. Laura Jocic about the role of dress in colonial Australian society. Great to have your company, and do tune in next month.